This from the Attorney General of the United States, Loretta Lynch, is the government's case against FIFA pretty much in a nutshell.
They corrupted the business of worldwide soccer to serve their interests and to enrich themselves.
And a very big business it is, too, from American public media. This is Market Play. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 27th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Global sport is the global lead story today. More specifically, for our purposes, the business of one particular sport. Early this morning, Zurich time, as you know, Swiss police, acting at the request of the American government, arrested seven top FIFA officials. FIFA being the French acronym for International Federation of Association Football, as soccer is sometimes called, but I digress. Anyway, 14 people in all have been indicted. Not, however, the man at the top, longtime FIFA president Sepp Blatter. Ed Dursey has covered a fair bit of soccer in his day. He used to do the business of sports with us. He is now a senior vice president at Universal Sports Network. Ed, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, Kai. It's great to talk to you.
The guy everybody's talking about today is, of course, Sepp Blatter, the president of FIFA. Give us the thumbnail sketch. Who is this guy? Where did he come from?
Well, you know, he's been described as the quintessential Swiss concierge, right? So he knows everybody. He makes everything happen for everybody. He's been, the head of FIFA for a long number of years here. And, you know, he's basically been said to have been running sort of a corrupt organization for the better part of two decades.
Has he been running it with the purse strings? I mean, he gives out money to sort of get his way. That's the allegation.
Yeah. I mean, in this particular indictment, you know, we're seeing charges of more than $150 million in bribes paid by sports marketing agencies. And then, of course, sort of the underlying bribery for actually obtaining the rights to host the World Cup. And you've seen a number of these stories that have come out where offers of, you know, well into seven figures for individuals to change their votes.
Give us a sense of how large, I guess, these folks lived. I mean, Sepp Blatter flies around in private planes. He stays in $3,000 a night hotel rooms.
You've pretty much said it. I mean, Blatter has a huge expense budget. He lives very well. You see the figures being thrown around here in terms of the size of the bribes being paid. You can imagine, you know, what hasn't been uncovered yet.
Is it Sepp Blatter's organization? I mean, he has stocked it with his folks.
Yeah, I mean, people basically said that if you wanted to taste any of sort of the gravy train, you needed to, you know, sort of prove your loyalty to him and do what he said.
This election that's supposed to be held to replace him or to, I guess, reelect him in a couple of days, is that still going to happen as far as you know?
There have been some calls to postpone that election, so we'll see whether that happens. I think UEFA, the European organization governing soccer, has called for that. Yeah. But I would not be surprised if this election still goes through and he is still elected. That doesn't mean that that will stay in perpetuity, but don't be surprised.
Where does FIFA get its money? Is it all broadcast rights and sponsorships?
Well, the most part of it is sponsorships. If you go and you look, you know, at the sponsorships that FIFA have, it is a who's who of international corporations from, you know, Coca-Cola on up.
Do you expect, and granted it's early days, do you expect this is going to change anything?
Well, I think it's going to change things a lot for FIFA. I mean, clearly, you know, U.S. Attorney Loretta Lynch said that this is not going to stop here. And, you know, clearly Sepp Blatter, I think, is the target for this investigation, and now that they have rolled up a number of FIFA officials, and including a couple of vice presidents, I think that the target is clear where they want to go with this.
Ed Dursey at Universal Sports Network. Ed, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Kai.
We talked about FIFA's sponsors, Ed and I. They have been, shall we say, circumspect today. Adidas, the group's oldest backer, urged FIFA to, and this is a quote, continue to establish and follow transparent compliance standards in everything they do. McDonald's said it, quoting again, takes matters of ethics and corruption very seriously, and the news from the U.S. Department of Justice is extremely concerning. End of quote. Not all that concerning were the goings-on on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. I'll tell you what, it's been a busy couple of days for the Justice Department. Before the FIFA thing broke this morning, The DOJ was in the news for the consent decree that it's worked out with the city of Cleveland, Ohio, and its police department. The agreement still does have to be approved by a judge, but assuming it is, who's going to pay? Because reform is never, ever cheap. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
The Justice Department started investigating the Cleveland Police Department in 2013, concluding in a report last December that the department used unreasonable and sometimes unnecessary force. The agreement keeps Cleveland out of a long, expensive court fight, but
everything has to be paid for.
That's Steve Dettelbach, U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Ohio. By everything, he means requirements in the agreement for things like training officers to deal better with minorities and people who are mentally ill. Also equipment, like computers and patrol cars.
That officers in their car should connect up with all the data that we collect on people that they're arresting and the dangers that they're facing every day.
Nobody's saying how much all this will cost. Mayor Frank Jackson says it'll be millions, and he'll be looking for what he calls external help from people like Michael Stanek, owner of Cleveland Cycle Tours and CFO of Hunt Imaging, which makes toner.
I think if there were some training programs that they were looking to implement, I think would be very appropriate for me as a small businessman to help out with.
How much help would he give?
8,000, maybe.
But Stanek says it would have to be earmarked for a specific program. Cleveland's business community has dipped into its pockets before. It helped fund an education reform program a few years ago. Joe Roman heads the Greater Cleveland Partnership, the city's Chamber of Commerce.
The community realizes this is going to need to be a public-private partnership, and I think everybody is all in trying to figure out what the right role is that they can play.
And how much it'll cost. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's news of the news media that's worth a mention today. In fact, it's news of news media that is new media. See what I did there? Vox Media, which has a bunch of sites, including Vox.com and The Verge, is buying Recode, the tech news site run by Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg, both late of The Wall Street Journal. Recode gets access to Vox's 50-million-plus user base and also to something else perhaps equally important, as Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains.
If you go to a news website, what do you see? Headlines, text, maybe photos or video? It all works together. If you peek behind the scenes, you'd probably see chaos, says newspaper analyst Ken Doctor. Chaos created by decades of updates and adjustments as old media transformed into new media.
Endless meetings, endless investments, and endless years go by in trying to transform legacy companies to being what are essentially digital-first companies.
Vox basically skipped all this. It was born digital, and it built a publishing system for the digital age. It's called Chorus.
Chorus is a killer technology. It is that understanding technology is the core of the new business.
What stands Chorus apart is that everything works in, well, harmony.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Photos, text, links, tweets, they're all seamlessly integrated, all aimed at getting in-depth stories out quickly. Vox has also adapted that same technology to make it easier to target ads. And that's something the news industry needs to do a lot more of, says Amy Mitchell, head of journalism research at the Pew Center.
Print advertising dollar has continued to decline. Digital has grown a bit, but it's not been able to keep up with the decline that's being seen in print.
And Ken Doctor says that's where Vox's Chorus technology could be key, showing news organizations how to sing a new tune. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
With schools getting ready to finish up for the year, teachers and administrators in a lot of districts are already planning for the fall. Plans that might include technology, laptops and tablets, one for each kid for the very first time. It's true what they say, you know, that technology really can change everything. So Marketplace's Adrian Hill went down to Vista, California in San Diego County to see up close and personal what happens when you give iPads to a bunch of middle schoolers.
When Vita Middle School got a grant to hand every one of its 680 students an iPad with a free 4G connection, parents were nervous. Here's Principal Eric Shigela.
We have a large population of students who walk, and so the fear was you're putting a $700 or $800 device in my 11-year-old's hand, and they have to get home.
So Shigela talked to the local police officers and hit the streets in the working-class neighborhood around the school.
We had to talk to pawn shops and other places to make sure that they knew, hey, the school has these. So if you start seeing iPads all of a sudden show up, it's because they're probably stolen. Can you contact us?
The VITA in VITA Middle School is the Vista Innovation and Design Academy. It's a one-year-old magnet school that replaced a struggling school called Washington Middle. Shigela describes the architecture as Cold War-ish. Long rows of classrooms, outdoor hallways, all with a fresh coat of paint and regular appearances by the new school's mascot, a shark. The old teacher's lounge has been turned into a maker space called iStudio. Today is building day. A class of sixth graders is hard at work creating models of carnival attractions with wood blocks, cardboard, plastic containers. Those models began as designs on their iPads.
We're making a haunted house.
What will the glass bits be?
So we're going to
make broken CDs.
Broken CDs, but we're using it as broken glass.
That was supposed to be like this ride that spins in the middle, spins to the pegs.
The spinning ride also involves sprinklers, a concession stand, sharks. It's very ambitious. Traditional classes have also been transformed by the technology. William Olive has been teaching history for 27 years.
We now have students look at historical dilemmas and be problem solvers. How would you interpret that?
He helps students use the tech to explore and create. And many of his students didn't have that access before. Not at school or at home. A third of the students in the upper grades here are homeless.
For instance, I teach a junior Model U Nations club, and 13 of the 19 students do not have a computer or printer at home. And for them to have access to an iPad is revolutionary.
They research, they create presentations, they have a whole new set of questions about the world when they come into class. Everything from the South China Sea to the Sudan.
It gives them more of a level playing field. It also helps their families, because their families now have access to technology and are beginning to understand it.
But as we learn from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. I sat down with a group of sixth graders, Isaac, Sydney, and Destiny, to find out how it feels to be handed a tablet.
I felt really nervous because my parents hadn't paid insurance for the first week, so they're all pressuring me. Don't drop it. Don't lose it. Don't give it to a friend. Don't do anything with it. Just work.
I definitely felt both excited and nervous. I was nervous because I was wondering how much we're going to use this, am I going to bring it every day? Like, how am I going to schedule what I'm going to do with my iPad?
Right now we're going through a really difficult time at home, so it's like I really can't afford to lose it or do anything like that, because then we would have to pay, even though I have insurance, we would have to pay some.
Principal Shigela feels a new responsibility too, one with a bigger price tag. How to keep this all going?
Our richest kid and our poorest kid, there is no difference in access and opportunity for learning for them at this point.
The grant from a group called Digital Promise and Verizon lasts only 2 years. After that, they get to keep the iPads, but they lose the free 4G connections.
I'm scared to death. Yeah, it's been such a blessing. I don't think our kids could imagine not having access.
Now he says district and city officials are working on a plan, some plan, to keep the access and expand it to even more kids.
Go VITA!
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
There are all kinds of things that happen when you give a kid a laptop. We made an animated video about some of them, which is, if you ask me, pretty good. You can check it out at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Why would they put a contaminated landfill here in this neighborhood? Right here in my front door.
Pollution as the local economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 121 points today, 2/3%, closed at 18,162. The NASDAQ rose 73 points, 1.4%, 5106. The S&P 500 added 19 points, 0.9%, finished things at 21.23. We are always reminding ourselves and you that daily numbers don't matter. They change every day. Weekly numbers, not much better. Monthly, well, they seem more meaningful, but consider this. McDonald's got tired of the hubbub around its monthly sales numbers, lately bad monthly numbers. So its solution is that it's not going to release them anymore. McDonald's up 0.2% today on that news. You heard this one? Two luxury brands walk into a bar and announce lower earnings. One of them, Tiffany, shares up 10%. Sales were down less than expected. The other one, Michael Kors, off 24%. Sales fell more than forecast. The moral of the story, everybody, capitalism is all about expectations, y'all. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. President Obama is scheduled to be at the National Hurricane Center in Florida for a briefing on the upcoming hurricane season. The National Association of Realtors issues its monthly pending home sales index. And tomorrow is National Hamburger Day. People, I sense that you are ready to rise to the occasion. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Yankee Stadium in New York City and Levi's Stadium, home to football's San Francisco 49ers in Santa Clara, California, have a continent and completely different sports setting them apart from one another. But they do have something very important in common. Goldman Sachs. Over the past 10 years, Goldman has helped round up the financing for 30 professional stadiums, including, most recently, a proposed stadium in Carson, California, just south of downtown L.A., that would be shared by the, for now anyway, San Diego Chargers and the, for now anyway, Oakland Raiders. It would be, if built at the projected cost of 1.7 billion simoleons, the most expensive stadium in the country. Tim Logan wrote about Goldman and the NFL for the Los Angeles Times. Tim, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here.
Why has Goldman Sachs become such a key player in stadium financing?
It's interesting. There are several of the big investment banks that do this, but yeah. Goldman is the best at it. A lot of it actually comes back to one guy, a banker there by the name of Greg Carey, who 15 years ago did a deal for the New England Patriots for their new stadium in Foxborough and was able to design a lending structure that lowered their interest rates and made them a lot of money and then gave them a sort of supercharged stadium that over the long run they've been able to use to make a lot more revenue for the team. Now, there are other people at Goldman who have developed this expertise sort of in his group. He's not even working on this deal in Carson, but they've sort of become the resource by being innovative. They've been the ones who have come up with all the new innovations in this business.
Like, what do they do? What are some of the key things?
Well, they were early in the business of figuring out how to issue tax-exempt bonds for these stadiums that allowed the teams to get lower interest rates. And lately, in the last two NFL deals they've worked, in Santa Clara and now in Carson.
Up in San Francisco, yeah.
San Francisco 49ers deal in Santa Clara, and now this proposed stadium for the Chargers in Carson. They have designed these very complicated public-private partnerships that allow for very little upfront money from the taxpayers and sort of a long-term profit stream for the team.
Personal seat licenses, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Box sales.
Yes, personal seat licenses have become huge, especially here.
Quickly remind us what those are.
That's where you get to pay the football team tens of thousands of dollars, maybe, for the right to buy a season ticket.
Yeah, and the right to buy it. In other words, you have to pay that to pay them more.
Exactly. Yeah. And hopefully you like football. I mean, the Santa Clara deal included, I want to say, about $350 million in personal seat licenses. The Carson, if it's actually a two-team stadium housing both the Chargers and the Raiders, they're targeting as much as $800 million in personal seat licenses. That's the kind of money that influences where a team goes. Mm-hmm. That's why the Chargers want to move to Los Angeles. That's the kind of thing that attracts big investors.
We mentioned that there's not a whole lot of interest in public financing of these stadiums anymore, but there are substantial givebacks. There are property tax givebacks. There are, I mean, all kinds of things.
Yeah, this is what doesn't get said in the press releases about these deals, but there's a lot of ways that this structure that they're doing will help the Chargers and the Raiders and Goldman Sachs. The PSLs are the biggest piece. If they can raise $800 million of PSLs, and if they can sell it through a public authority, a public entity that owns a public stadium, that money is not taxed. So depending on what tax rate the Chargers, San Diego Chargers, would be paying, they'll see all that money into the stadium deal as opposed to having, if they were doing it themselves, they would have to pay taxes on that. Same thing goes for naming rights, sponsorship deals. Then there's property taxes. Again, the stadium will be publicly owned, so it won't pay property taxes. Now, the Chargers and the Raiders will have to pay local taxes on their use of the stadium, but it's hard to know if that's as much as they would pay owning a $1.7 billion stadium.
What's your guess? Which of these stadiums gets built?
That's a good question. Until a couple weeks ago, I would have said Inglewood was definitely the favorite. That seems to be shifting. Really, it's up to the 32 billionaires who run the NFL. and we just don't know what they think yet.
Tim Logan, business writer for the Los Angeles Times. Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Percent of all the electricity in this country is generated by coal-fired power plants. With those coal-fired power plants comes coal ash, a toxic residue that often is stored in ponds or in landfills. Ponds or landfills that can and do leak. Back in 2008, more than a billion gallons of coal ash was released into the Emory River in Tennessee. It was the biggest ash spill ever in this country. A lot of the residue from that spill was hauled down to a landfill in Perry County, Alabama. And residents of that mostly African-American county have now filed suit, claiming damages as a result of the ash. But what's a poor county to do when the landfill has made itself a key part of the local economy? From Uniontown, Alabama, Gigi Duban has that story.
William Gibson lives across the street from the Arrowhead Landfill, just off a two-way country road in Perry County, Alabama, about 30 minutes outside of Selma. Sometimes he says it smells like rotten eggs. Garbage is one thing.
I'm fine with that. But why would they put a contaminated landfill here in this neighborhood? Right here in my front door.
The contamination Gibson is referring to arrived 6 years ago. 4 million tons of coal ash hauled in after a disastrous dam breach in Tennessee. Several residents filed a civil rights complaint with the Environmental Protection Agency, saying the landfill is lowering property values, causing illness, and letting toxic chemicals flow into nearby creeks. Gibson takes me toward the road in front of his house, where he says runoff from the landfill heads into a ditch and ultimately trickles into this creek.
This comes on the road and runs right through there.
He says water at his house used to run clear from the tap. Now, he says there's a white film around his pots and pans. He says he just can't tell what's in the water, and he's worried. Perry County Commissioner Tim Sanderson says he doesn't buy any claims the landfill is unsafe.
I've always been a firm believer in show me some proof. You make allegations all day long.
Fact is, Perry County needs this landfill. People have been leaving in droves. The unemployment rate is among the highest in the state. Schools are closing. So are restaurants and shops.
Jobs are not here. So people are going to where the jobs are because of gas prices and other reasons.
Perry County's median household income is $28,000. Most people there are African American. For every ton of waste collected at Arrowhead, the county gets a dollar. 4 million tons of coal ash meant $4 million. Plus hundreds of thousands of dollars in property taxes and savings on the county's own dumping fees. Sanderson says people who complain about a landfill in Perry County aren't being realistic.
You know, everybody was saying, oh, we're killing the kids, we're causing all these problems. Let's get to Mississippi and kill all their kids and cause problems over there. That's not the good Christian way.
Mike Smith, attorney for Green Group Holdings, which owns the landfill, takes me on a tour. He describes an elaborate liner system designed to protect groundwater, and he says the water is tested regularly.
It's not nearly as bad a water as you would think it would, or as other people have led the residents to believe it is.
Coal ash contains things like arsenic, mercury, lead, and boron, and environmentalists fear these chemicals can cause health problems. The Alabama Department of Environmental Management inspected the landfill for drainage problems last month. The result? Certain areas need to be stabilized with vegetation, and inspectors noted cloudy water leaving the landfill property where it shouldn't. Smith acknowledges some of the issues noted in the report and says they'll be addressed. He also points out that $4 million the coal ash deal brought Perry County was a windfall, some of which went to the schools.
But for that, they would have had a severe cutback in their services.
Arrowhead has also tried to win over residents by cleaning up parks and buying the high school a new PA system. But this month, Arrowhead started aggressively marketing itself as the place to dump coal ash. New EPA regulations require utilities to comply with strict standards. And as a landfill, Arrowhead isn't subject to the new EPA rules.
Now, we're getting to the area now where the sales have been closed.
Smith takes me to the area where the last load of ash is buried.
I mean, what happened to it? Is it just sitting there?
Yes, ma'am. It's underground. It is safely stored away.
If Arrowhead gets its wish, there will be lots more coal ash coming to Perry County. In Uniontown, Alabama, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which common sense wins a rare victory over corporate America. Taco Bell, as you might have heard, has decided to take artificial flavors and colors out of its offerings, including, for the detail-oriented among you, this. The company is going to switch from using artificial black pepper to something called natural black pepper flavor, which raises this very, I grant you, hair-splitting question. Do you suppose there's something wrong with actual black pepper? And we are out of here. The Dow up 121 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ gained 73 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 put on 19 points, about 0.9%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.